Well, welcome to this next session on the Ecclesiastes class, The Search for the Meaning of Life. And we are in session 5 here, and we're going to get started in chapter 3. So if you have your Bibles, I would encourage you to turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And we're going to look here at this awesome part of the book. There is an extended Hebrew poem here that launches off into this next section. So Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 1. Let's get into it. It says, "For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born, time to die, time to plant, a time to uproot what was planted, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to tear down, and a time to build up, a time to weep, and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to search and a time to count it as lost. A time to keep and a time to throw away. Verse 7, a time to tear and a time to sow. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace." This poem is structured in a very unique way. There's a literary device called a chiasmus, where a chiastic structure is an inversion. Essentially, what it does is you have something that is repeated in units, but it is done in an inverse way. So we're going to go back through the poem more slowly, and I'd like to comment on a few of these pairings. But you'll notice that there are some positive things that are mentioned, and then there are some negative things, and they're typically paired, a positive thing and a negative thing. But as you'll see, it starts out positive and positive first in the list in part A, and then switches to another section B with 4 lines where they all begin with a negative, and then B prime inverts that back to a positive first for the next 4 lines. A prime inverts A rather than positive, negative, it's negative, positive. And then in section C, there's an inversion of positive, negative, negative, positive. So that's the chiasmus here. It's an inversion structure. And it's a way to sort of like just, in the ancient world, this was very common. There's tons of examples in the Bible of chiastic structures. And they did this for when speaking, being able to track through how you're progressing in what you're saying. If you're starting at one place, you can then venture out and then invert and come back to the place where you were before, either through themes, different motifs, terminology and vocabulary, and other literary aspects as well. Okay, well, let's go back to the beginning here and talk a little bit about this poem in more depth. There are 7 double pairs in this entire poem. 14 pairs total, which this number is likely meant to represent some completeness with regard to all possible human activities. And these pairings, as we noted here, they're opposites of each other. This is actually another literary device called a polemarismos, where you say the extreme opposites of each other as a way of talking about everything that is also in between them as well. So when you say everything from hot to cold or from north to south, you're not just saying those extreme endpoints, but it's everything that happens in between all those. You're trying to basically express the whole gamut of a spectrum. And so that's what he's doing here, is that he's talking about, for example, in verse 2, a time to be born and a time to die. Well, those aren't the only 2 moments in a person's life. But he's saying that these 2 are the endpoints. They're like the bookshelf ends that delineate a person's life. They're born, and then they live, and then they die. The idea here is all about this time. Here in verse 1, see, for everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. Time is a big theme in wisdom literature, and this poem is all about time. And timing is everything in life. Wisdom promotes understanding how time works and the time for a particular activity and when to act and when to refrain from acting. There's a famous proverb in chapter 24 of the book of Proverbs that says, "Do not answer a fool according to his foolishness, lest you too become just like him." And then the next verse says, "Answer a fool according to his foolishness, lest he become wise in his own eyes." The key is to understanding what is the right time for doing any of these particular actions. And the focus here that Solomon is going to be presenting is that everything has its own time. There's a right time for everything, a proper time, a time that is fitting. And this time stems from the premise in wisdom literature that God has created the world. He's created the cosmos in a way such that everything follows an orderly pattern and thereby a designated timing. This orderliness that creation exhibits and the appropriate timing demonstrates the wisdom with which God used to create it. And this also applied then to human decisions and life experience as well. So while God has ordered the cosmos in a way that follows distinct patterns and activities, Solomon's not saying that all of these different things that have a time to happen, that they're following some sort of mechanistic or deterministic pattern. It's simply that God has so structured life that there is a proper time when each of these happen. The various circumstances that we're going to go through in this poem, they happen in the course of life, but it's not like a formula or some sort of preset mode. There's nothing that makes these have to happen at any particular moment in time as though it's predestined to happen, but simply that God, in his working out of the world and the way life was supposed to exist, included all of these. Therefore, if they are to happen in life, there is a time that they do happen. Sometimes in this poem, it's going to be a little difficult to pin down exactly what Solomon's referring to, and I'll point out the places where it's a little obscure. But they're mostly just generic references to different aspects and a range of different human situations. And so sometimes we can identify that they're supposed to be understood concretely as a definite event, like when you're born, it's an actual concrete event that happens. But some other times, like when you're talking about tearing things down or building things up, it could be literalistic, as in like some sort of construction project, as I'll talk about, or it could be figurative as well. The first verse here in this poem expresses the entire premise or theme of the poem, that everything has a season. There's a time for everything under heaven. And then following that, there will be this series of pairings to demonstrate and to sort of explore in this figurative completeness way that everything does have its time. Verse 2 here, there's a time to be born and a time to die. Everybody has these two points in their life, a time to plant and a time to uproot what was planted. So going from the human experience of birth and death, this is now agricultural metaphor here, but it could be literal too, that there's a time to put seed in the ground and plant crops, and there's a time to then uproot them at harvest, in which case the plant dies. This is also a birth and death cycle, but using just horticulture rather than human experience. 3, a time to kill and a time to heal. In the biblical culture, in the Old Covenant, there was a time in which you were to kill. There were certain laws which, if Israel broke, they carried with them the death penalty, capital punishment. And therefore, it was right and fitting at those times when the law was broken in those cases to then carry out the instruction God gave to kill the individual. Likewise, there's a time in which to heal. There's a time in which there's a point in life where if you're injured or if you've gone through a traumatic experience, to go through a season of healing. These two go hand in hand together. Verse 3, a time to tear down, time to build up. Like I mentioned, this could be a building, a construction project, but think of this metaphorically. What if it's an aspect of relationships? What if you're talking about the time when you're trying to sort of like remove something unhealthy from your life, an unhealthy relationship perhaps? Or then on the contrary, you're recognizing that a certain relationship is not as strong as it needs to be. It needs to be built up. There are times in our lives we probably could each remember when we needed to do that. We needed to tear something down. We needed to deconstruct it. And then another time, there was a time we knew we needed to actually put some construction labor in. We needed to build something up. We needed to reinforce something in our lives. And if there's any contractors, they clearly know what this means in a literal way, that there's times when you need to knock a wall down in order to then change something and then build it back up. Deconstruction is not always a negative thing. Sometimes in order to do something constructive, you first have to modify what's already there. Verse 4, a time to weep and a time to laugh. Weeping comes in all cases of sorrow and disappointment. Could be something happened at work, you lost your job. Could be loss of a relationship, a boyfriend, girlfriend broke up with you. Could be your own disappointment in that you let yourself down thinking that you're going to be able to achieve something and then you missed the mark and you didn't get to it. Whatever the case is for sorrow, there's a time to weep in life when we feel that pain. On the contrary, during seasons of success, during times when you're able to achieve your goals, or when you're able to experience that prosperity and blessing from the Lord, and time to celebrate and to laugh together. And these two pairings in verse 4 here, time to weep and a time to laugh, time to mourn, time to dance, they go hand in hand. Weeping and mourning, laughing and dancing, these describe two activities on these opposite ends of grieving, sorrow and pain, and happiness, joy, and celebration. And there's numerous, countless ways we could understand that in life. Now, verse 5 here, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. This is one of those more obscure references here in the poem. There are a couple ways to understand this verse. It's most likely probably referring to casting away stones in the sense of clearing them out of a field. There's a couple biblical references that talk about stones in a field and either they are being put there to ruin the field or they're being removed in order to cultivate the field. That's probably what's in mind here, casting away stones, meaning taking them out of the way so that something good can be done. And gathering stones together can likewise be either positive or negative. Could be to throw them into a field, for example, of an enemy, or it could be that you're gathering them together for a construction project like to build a wall or to build a structure, a sheepfold or something like that. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. If you've ever met somebody or seen somebody like a long-lost friend, that's a time to embrace. It's a time to hug each other because you have been separated for so long. Likewise, there's a time maybe when it's not appropriate to embrace. Maybe it's a time of a certain sensitive circumstance, or maybe there are other factors involved, but it takes wisdom to know when a time is right to embrace and when it's not. A time to search and a time to count as lost. Verse 6 here. If you misplace something in your house, how many of you go looking for it? Usually we do, right? There's a time to search for something. That is, when you can't find it. Now, how long do you search for it? Do you spend the rest of the day searching for it? Well, perhaps. Perhaps it's worth spending all that time searching for. What if you're looking for some pencil or pen that was on your desk and you thought it might have fallen behind the desk? So you look for it. You don't find it. You're going to spend that much energy on a pen or a pencil, or you're just going to go get another one. Now, what happens if it is some sort of a postcard, maybe, that a relative sent you when they were on some travels, and it has a lot of nostalgia and sentimental value to you? And you look behind the desk, you don't see it. You look under the desk, you don't see it. Do you stop there? If it really means something to you, you're going to continue looking for it. There's a certain appropriate value we attribute to items and that we search for them kind of in accordance with that value that we attach to it. But at some point, if it can't be found, there's a time at which continued investment is unwise, is foolish. If some things fall out of your pocket when you get out of the car and then at the grocery store, and then you drive home, and if you're looking for them at your house, you can look for them the rest of your life. You will never find them because they're not at your house. They're at the grocery store in the parking lot because they fell out of your pocket. Sometimes you just have to consider something to be lost and can't be found. There's a time to keep and a time to throw away. I know this is a favorite for a lot of people. How do you know when to keep stuff And how do you know when to purge and get rid of stuff? There's wisdom that needs to be used to figure out, is there a purpose for something? Or is there a reason to have something? I don't think we're supposed to become pack rats in life, so you can't keep everything. But then again, if you're a minimalist, sometimes you're always come up short on having what you need, because life requires different amenities, tools, devices, and things like that to function. So you have to keep some things in order to keep life going, but too many things clutters the house. So there's a time to keep stuff, and there's a point at which you got to get rid of some stuff. But maybe not throw it away. Maybe see if somebody else can use it. Maybe it can bless somebody else. But if not, there is always the garbage. And here we go. Number 7, time to tear and a time to sew. Now, I don't think parents want their kids just taking their clothes and tearing them. But in the biblical culture, there is an appropriate time in which tearing occurred. If you're experiencing deep grief or sorrow, that was a time, it was a cultural mannerism. You would tear your clothing to show the way that you're inside, you are just torn apart. You're just grieving so deeply. Similarly, if you're angry, that was also a time to tear your clothing to show the rage that was inside of you, that you're filled with anger and you tear your clothing. That's not a daily occurrence, but it was appropriate in the biblical culture. Likewise, if something is torn, it needs to be mended. There's a time in which to sew what has been torn. There's a time to be silent and a time to speak. I think we all can relate to this, where we've opened our mouth at the wrong time or said the wrong thing, and we realized that was a time we probably shouldn't have said anything. It's a time we should keep our mouth closed. But then there's times perhaps where we need to have the courage to open our mouth. We must speak into a situation, even if it's uncomfortable. There's a time to speak as well. And then finally, verse 8, a time to love, a time to hate, a time for war, and a time for peace. These deal with personal emotions here in the first line. And then the second line is like a socio-political conditions. There's a time to love. There's a time to show affection, to show kindness. And there's a time to not. There's a time to hate. Now, this isn't hate in the sense of having this vehement sort of like animosity towards somebody. Hate is in the sense of just reserving yourself from showing kindness and love to somebody. In wisdom, if there's a person who has deeply wronged you, or there's a person who you know to be a fool or to be somebody who is having unclean spiritual influences in their life and they would take advantage of you or they would do you harm, that's not a person that you should open your heart up to. Not a person that you should then be demonstrating love toward in that sense. Now, we should always be loving and kind in our mannerisms, but that doesn't mean that we have to have a relationship and have that close affection with everybody. Likewise, there's people who need love and they need to feel the kindness and the warmth of another person who cares about their life and what they're going through. And lastly, there's a time for war, a time for peace. In the biblical culture, in the time of Israel, war was a commonplace. They went out every year to war. Israel had to defend from invasion time and time again in the biblical record. And there's a time for peace. When the monarchy got established in the land of Canaan under King Saul and then finally King David, and King David and King Solomon experienced long-term periods of peace in Israel's history. But it didn't last. There eventually came additional warfare later on, even internal civil warfare within the different Israelite nations. So at the end of this entire poem here, we see that there is a time and a place for everything. That's what Solomon's trying to present in this poem. So let's go on then to what does he say next. In verse 9, he says, well, what profit is there to the worker from his labor? Now, this sounds awfully familiar. This is something that has come up many times already. We can think back to even in the beginning, this is part of the main question that Solomon is pursuing from chapter 1, verse 3. What gain does a person get from their labor. He's asking the same question here. What profit is there? He also asks this in chapter 2, verse 22. And so this is how he responds. He says, I've seen the business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. He's referring to all the work that happens under the sun on earth, all the things that human people are occupied with doing, the work that they're doing. That's the business that God has given to the children of men or humankind to be busy with. They fill their days with the work. Verse 11, he has made everything appropriate in its time. This is among one of the most difficult verses in the whole book of Ecclesiastes. Along with this phrase and the next one, also he has set eternity in their hearts, yet not in such a way that a man can find out the work that God has done from the beginning even to the end. This phrase here, that God has made everything appropriate in its time. The problem here is that if we take this in isolation, we would probably come with a misunderstanding. This actually is part of the poem, not part of the actual poem structure, but it connects to the poem, that the whole list of everything, that there's a season for everything, and there's a time for this and that and the other. This is because God is the one who has ordered the cosmos. Remember what I said at the beginning, that's Solomon's framework from a wisdom literature perspective. And everything follows these course patterns in life. And so everything has its time, and God has made everything to have its appropriate time. What it says here, he has set eternity in their hearts. There's two ways to look at this. I think the best way to see it is that it's a reference to time, that God has set a perspective of time in people's hearts. Humans know that there's a past. They know that there's a present. They know there's a future. They conceptualize the progression of time. And this is important because of the follow-up statement that, yet not in such a way that a man can find out the work that God has done from the beginning to the end. So even though people understand there's a long course of time in history, the completeness of understanding that is beyond their grasp, that no one can understand what God has done and all the appropriatenesses of the different times of things and activities from the start to finish. Now, the other way that this could be understood is that God has placed in the human heart this deep desire, this sort of craving, almost like a compulsion to have to search out and understand the complexities of the character and the nature of the world and everything in it. I think that rings true. I think humans have an endless curiosity. I think we seek to know. We crave to know answers, and we are not satisfied when we don't find them. And so I think that can also fit the context here too, that there is this desire to understand the world and everything that goes on, because that is one of Solomon's observations, is that, you know, and he's looking for it himself, that he's looking to understand the big scope, what's the big picture going on here under the sun, and that God has placed this in people's hearts, but not in a way that actually enables them to really actually have a grasp of the big picture, to understand from beginning to end all that transpires on earth. And then in verse 12, verses 12 through 15 actually contain two responses that Solomon offers. They're kind of like confessions, and they both begin verse 12 with I know and then something, and then verse 14, I know and then something. So I'll just mark that here. These are like the two cues for these two different responses. Now, these two responses about the enigma of time and events that happen in life, this first response here, both responses are not like these assertions, so to say, of observations. They're kind of confessional statements. He's just confessing what he understands to be true. He says, I know that there is nothing better for them, for people, humankind, than to rejoice and to do good as long as they live. And also that each one should eat and drink and enjoy the good that results, or the good resulting from all his labor. This is the gift of God. This wording is very similar to a sentiment that Solomon mentioned in the last session we had in chapter 2, verse 24, actually, where he said that there's nothing better for a person than he should eat, drink, and make his soul enjoy the good in his labor. This also I saw that is from the hand of God. The hand of God is replaced with the gift of God. So Solomon is looking here, and like I said, it's not observational data. He's not saying that I saw that this is the what needs to happen, but he's saying, given everything that happens in the world, all the timing things that are beyond human comprehension, that really are God's business, because the business that God has given to humankind is to busy themselves with the work that is under the sun that he's given to them. He's saying, well, then if we can't know the big picture and see the grand scheme of everything in order to be able to control and manipulate it for our own benefit or profit, then he kind of like gives this concession that, well, then at least what we do know is that God has given us this work and we should enjoy it. We should rejoice and do good as long as we live, and that we should eat and drink and enjoy the good that results from our labor. This is a gift from God. He's kind of like couching here is, so what do we know given our perspective? Because we don't have the perspective we would desire. At least Solomon doesn't, and I don't think anybody truly has the perspective they desire about life in the world. But he says there is something that we can know. We can know that God has given us this assignment to work. And that work, we should work hard and enjoy what we're doing and be pleased with the work, have satisfaction in our work, and then enjoy what is produced by that work. Be able to take the revenue and purchase, or even through our work, be able to enjoy the crops that are harvested. If you're in agriculture back then, most people planted and harvested crops. They had herds of cattle. And so it would be part of that work that they'd be able to enjoy directly. But if you're a different type of a laborer or a merchant of types, the work that you do, you'd be able to then enjoy the basic elements of life, which is eating and drinking, eating food and drinking beverages. This is the good that Solomon says that results from work. Now, his second confession here is, he says in verse 14, I know that whatever God does, that's his focus here, whatever God does will be forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. And God has done it so that people should fear before him. Here, in contrast to the focus on people in verses 12 and 13, he now focuses on God's work. And he notices there's a big difference. Whatever God does is permanent, not going anywhere. And no matter what people do, no matter how hard they struggle, they're not going to be able to change the work that God has done. And this work is in the way that he has structured and organized the cosmos. And the way that life, and the way that there's times for everything, all this is God's work, not humans. And humans can't do anything to change that work. We are not God. God is God. And Solomon is understanding here that there can be no modifications from a human interjecting into God's plans and God's purposes. Now, interestingly, at the end here, this has been done, Solomon says, so that people should fear before him. This fear isn't this type of like terror of like being so afraid you're going to run and hide from God because he's a monster or he's scary or something. This fear is about a disposition of the heart, an attitude toward understanding the power and might of God, and thereby yielding yourself to submit to him in obedience under his authority as the rightful ruler of the world. So this second concession is about understanding the place of humans, that they are below God, and that everything that God does and how God is running the universe and has organized and set up the cosmos, this is all done so people recognize he's God, and that they then have that proper orientation with respect to him and submit to him in obedience. And then to conclude this section in 15, Solomon brings back up a point that he began with way back in chapter 1, that which is has already been, and that which is to be has already been, and God seeks that which is pursued. Previously, in chapter 1, the language here is almost exactly the same, that what has been will be, and what has been done is what will be done from chapter 1, verse 9. There's nothing new under the sun. So this kind of cyclical pattern here, Solomon brings it back up that everything that God does, he's doing, and people are not going to change that pattern. That pattern is set. Now, this last phrase here is also one of the most difficult in the whole book of Ecclesiastes. God seeks that which is pursued. If you'd peruse any number of translations, you'll see there's probably a wide variety of translations for this phrase. I think probably the two best ways to understand this are that the Hebrew word here can refer to things that you're actually going after, pursuing, such as everything that people are pursuing in the book of Ecclesiastes. People are striving after things, and that God actually is seeking those things that people are pursuing. But they could also be understood, and this may actually fit better in the present context here in verse 15, that the Hebrew can also mean things that have been kind of chased away or have passed, referring to events that have kind of like been chased out of the present, thereby are no longer in the present, they're in the past. That things that have been will be, that this whole theme of this cyclical or this cycle of life, that God is seeking the things that have been passed, because what happens is the things that have been passed then happen again. That's the point that Solomon's making here, is that everything in life, nothing is new. Things just keep on going around in circles. What has been will be, and whatever will be has been. Things happen in this kind of cyclical fashion. Therefore, God is seeking the things that have passed by or have been chased away from the present to then bring them back around again, because that is the way he has structured life. So that is the beginning of chapter 3 in the poem on the mystery of time. We're going to take a break here and be back with you in the next session.